Hello, I'm Margaret Rogers, the CEO of the Community Resource Unit. When Crew developed this series of stories on grassroots change and leadership, we wanted to explore theories of change. But we wanted to do that in a way that was easy to understand and identify with. So to wrap up this series, we invited two other leaders from the sector, Leslie Chenoweth and Karen Swift, to reflect on these five stories and to link what they have heard back to their understanding of change and leadership. Here they are in conversation with journalist Nance Haxton.
Could we get your names firstly? Thank you, Leslie.
Well, I'm Leslie Chenoweth. I'm a professor at Griffith University, but now retired.
Lovely. And Karen?
Hi, Nance. Yeah, my name's Karen Swift, and I've been around the traps and a long-term supporter of Crew and, I guess, activist and advocate in the... I'm currently working at QDN.
Wonderful. Thank you both for joining us today for Crucial Conversations. Can we start with this is the closing podcast of our series. Have you had a chance to listen to the Crucial Conversations that have been produced so far? Could you give us your thoughts on some of those stories and perhaps what it made you think of with your experience as well? Karen, if we could start with you.
Yeah, sure. I think overall, the stories demonstrate the power of storytelling and how we all learn from each other's experience. And personally, for my life at the moment, with the introduction of the NDIS, we've had the opportunity to go from being in a rather large service to a smaller, more boutique service where we can self-manage our own team. And these stories are absolutely vital to my learning at the moment around what it takes to have a good life and be in control and who has the power.
Were there some aspects that brought back memories, some good and bad as well from your own progress?
Well, I particularly related to all of the stories, but hearing Josie's and her struggle with supporting her sister and perhaps being in a situation where you don't always have choice, you know, and you've got to kind of put up with the best of the worst option.
Does it show how far we've come, but also in some ways how far there is to go still?
Yeah, I think these stories are timeless. They don't age. We all need to think and have opportunities to think about what makes a good life for ourselves and people who are vulnerable.
And Crew's mission, I suppose, it's still relevant now, even though there has been so much progress made. It's still important to have that support.
Absolutely. There's always going to be times where you need to just reflect and to have that opportunity to think outside the square of what's happening at that moment. And I think Crew does that really well.
And Leslie, what were some of the thoughts you had listening to these podcasts?
I thought they were just, I like your word, timeless, Karen, because I felt they were timeless. I suppose for me, these were people I know and have known over a long time, and yet there were still things I learned about them from the podcasts. But I think... And really reflecting on all of those stories, these are all people who have been leaders in different kinds of ways. And yet, for me, there was some really common elements. All of them had a vision for something better, either for themselves or for their family or for others or for how we do support people. So... That came through really, really powerfully for me, that people had a vision and they just kept at it. That was the other thing. For some of them, these were really long struggles and they persevered against often really trying obstacles and challenges.
Were there any particular moments or reflections that really stayed with you?
Oh, certainly, because some of the things that were shared, I remember when they happened. certainly listening to Anne's story, and that's probably a story that was quite similar to my own in terms of, you know, having this knowing that we really needed to do things better, but how do you do that, and how do you get the framework and frameworks and the knowledge, and what does that take? So there was a lot about that, and I think like there were just a couple of left field things that came for me, like how many of these people came from the bush, you know. If you grow up in Cunnamulla or St George or, you know, regional towns, I think it says something about Queensland. These are tough people. And there was a real resilience that came through that. And that was just something that came to me about them all. Admittedly, everybody had to move to the city to get the support they needed. You know, that was really very telling. And the other piece to it was, and this is, I suppose, for me as an educator, that quite a number of them pursued education to get the skills and the tools they needed to actually make their vision happen. So Josie went and studied social work. Anne Cross studied social work. I did too. Kevin did, you know, a social science. Like, It's like people were on this journey and they thought, well, what do I need? And they went and got it.
What does it say about the determination of people then? Before, really, perhaps it was more of a social conversation that people were having now with the NDIS and other aspects, that these sort of issues that they fought so hard for are more accepted.
Yes, they are, and certainly much has changed, but I think there's also some big lessons that somehow we have to keep on learning. It's like you can't just assume that everything's going to be okay because we have got a program or a policy or this whole agenda with the NDIS. Well, it's all about power and control, and choice and control, and then it'll happen. Because I think what these stories illustrate, you have to keep on about that. You can't just say, well, we've got that, because there's always slippage.
I noticed that with Anne's story, it resonated a lot for me about what I'm doing in my paid work at the moment. She talked about there being these bum fights between who's responsible for what. And that's exactly what we're going through now with the NDIS, with a whole range of things that, you know, through the health system, through transport, and who's responsible for that. And so as things change, there's always these perennial issues that we're dealing with.
So the fight continues in many ways. It's like a constant battle to make sure these rights aren't eroded.
That's right.
What about family support? I mean, that seems to be a common theme as well. How important was that for you to support your vision for how you wanted to live your life?
Well, I always had a very supportive family, but they were sort of supporting me from behind the scenes, not as out front as some of the families in this scenario. Like, you know, my dad was from a non-English speaking background, and my mum has been deaf since she was 14, so they weren't sort of out the front, but always supporting me from behind, and very key to my moral support in where I went in life. But yeah, so it was kind of, you know, through the power of friends that I had at the time that were doing those sort of things and challenging the system and moving out of home or various other settings to live in the community for the first time, that sort of provided impetus for me to make those changes. So, yeah, I guess, yeah, for me, the power of storytelling is really powerful in all of these stories.
Did you always have that vision that you wanted to live independently?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like, my brothers all grew up and left home, so why wouldn't I? So, yeah, it was just a normal part of life, and I never doubted that I would.
And there's a bit of an intersection here between both your story and Leslie's as well, that your education aspect here, you went to university and Leslie was one of your teachers.
That's right. Leslie was my first teacher in disability services or studies. And so, yes, it's very special to be here with her today.
What do you remember of that time, Leslie?
Well, I met Karen. She was doing an additional year to get her year 12.
And it's funny because, to my mind, they made high school really hard. But then once I got to uni,
yep,
there were all these services. It was like they rolled out the welcome mat. There was all these services. And I don't want to set up a false sense of security, but there was a lot of services, disability support, lecturers that were supportive, exams and everything in alternative formats. It was like, oh, wow.
I can do this. But I remember thinking my strategy then, we'd already had a student. Oh, look, we're talking early 90s. Yeah. This is pioneer days. We'd had a student with a disability, and here was Karen. And I introduced you because had already begun studying at the university. And in some ways, that to me is like the power of you can't be it if you can't see it.
That's right.
And there he was. And, you know, of course people with disabilities should be able to study at university, and what sort of supports do we need? And universities were really starting to think through, well, what does that mean?
And I guess in terms of advocacy, one of the strategies that really resonated with me in the stories is that things aren't just a given. And this was from Margaret Ward when she said that things aren't a given. You actually need purposeful strategy, because it's not just without that, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen just because we feel good about it. We need purposeful strategy and those, you know, strategic conversations to keep it moving forward.
You know, to get a good life, it's more than just having the right policies or the right programs. It takes so much more. And it speaks to having families that are alongside you or family members that are out front arguing for you. This came through in the stories. Or you've got to have friends, or you've got to just give it a go without enough funding. And so much of that is about relationships and ordinary people and people's attitudes and beliefs. That's, you've got to have that too. And I think there's, I don't know, but maybe there's something we need to learn in the rollout of the NDIS, where it's all very well, we've got these wonderful principles, objects and principles of the Act and all of how that is framed. But until we tackle the broader issue, you know, it's going to be a challenge, I think.
What do you think are some ways that we should, as a society, really respond to that? What are some of the ways we could change that?
I think the NDIS certainly is one step in addressing that, in that finally we've got a system where potentially everyone who needs it can get support. But I think behind that you've got to have the structure and the good values and the and things like what we're doing today to inform what that looks like for people. I also think you need some good social policy, some unapologetically good social policy that puts things like transport and health and all those interface issues on the table so that they can also be addressed well for people.
And the visibility of people with a disability in society?
Absolutely. I mean, that's almost a given. If we're not more visible, then people won't see us. So to turn that on its head, if we can be more visible and people learning our stories and learning, you know, the struggles that we've experienced and what it takes, then, yeah, that will go a step further into improving our acceptance and go a step forward to having a good life.
Are you finding that in your role now?
I deal with a whole range of policy issues, but, yeah, it's really about people with disabilities being at the table and having that voice and being able to inform those strategic conversations to lead to good outcomes. That's really important.
So those roundtables are quite effective in getting people's views across, people with disabilities, or it's not heard.
That's right. Because often people who are in those positions, like, you know, doctors, health professionals, policymakers, you know, they haven't actually had an opportunity to have conversation with people with disabilities. So they're often working without that knowledge. So it's so vital to bring that together so people can have that informed basis to come from.
This series is brought to you by CREW, the Community Resource Unit. CREW exists to create positive change so that people with disability will be welcomed, respected and appreciated in their communities. For more information, please visit our website at cru.org.au.
Leslie, for you, you've seen a lot of change, I imagine, in the years you've worked in this sector.
Yes, indeed, a lot of change. But just picking up on what Karen was talking about, I think with the NDIS, like we've moved, it's a highly individualised kind of model where there's this assumption that, you know, here's an individual or a family with a family member, and they just need to tell us what they want and then there'll be funding to make that happen. And it sort of harks to my earlier point about, you know, it's much more than about programs and funding. It's all those other things of ordinary people and relationships. And but what you were just talking about, Karen, that how do we have people come together to have those sorts of conversations? Well, that doesn't happen in the NDIS. The NDIS is a very instrumental, you know, you have a need, here's your money, just go and live your life. And as we know from decades of this work, it's so much more than that. And that's why I think organisations like CREW, for decades now, have provided those very opportunities for people to come together, people with disabilities, lots of families, but also professionals and also the people who are the policy makers. Because I think what one thing I've learned is you have to journey with people over time. People, you ask lots of people, like, what do you want in your life? They can't tell you, you know. So I think we make big assumptions that people already have a vision and they know how to operationalise that. It's very technical kind of approach. So we do need those spaces and places and opportunities for the roundtables where you can bring in people. And CREW over many years has provided that, and in a remarkable way, I think.
So while it's good to have a focus on the individual, it's not so great if everything becomes more fragmented and difficult to organise.
That's right, because I've often reflected similar to Josie, where she asked herself in the video, in her podcast, about I can do this for other people, why can't I do it for myself? And I think that's the importance of that, brings together the importance of peer support and organisations like CREW that have give people that opportunity to think about what does this mean for me and my family and my family's person's struggle.
And that also relates to, I think, Marg Ward or Jeremy Ward said, you know, can't just wish for this stuff. You've actually got to nut it out and have that strategic, like, what is our strategy and what are we going to do and how.
That's right.
You need alliances to do that. Mm. You can't do that on your own. Mm. And those alliances included, and I think Anne Cross talked about this too, you know, there were professionals as well as family members and people with disabilities. So, but it is about, I think, where do we get the opportunities to bring those people together? and those alliances.
And I find a really good link or connector is the power to tell stories.
Yes.
Because that's often what informs people's knowledge. I was reading something on the weekend about how do we get our position on things, and it's often through storytelling and not just people's real stories, but stories that might be shared through other mediums like movies and television. That's how we often form our opinions about things. So
people don't feel alone.
That's right. And it's a really good, can be sometimes strategic to share a particular story so that someone understands a point of view or...
And some of the stories, I think, Leslie, you've been involved in this field for decades, and I just think you started with that PhD. Can we reflect on that and the deinstitutionalisation, really, and what you remember of that time and how far we've come?
Well, I sort of came to the PhD after having gotten involved in the disability sector through the Commonwealth Rehab Service and then CRU and then... went and did that, a bit like a number of our storytellers who, you know, had this, lived and saw this stuff and thought, oh, I have to get some education type skills. So it was in the 90s and we were in this period of what was called institutional reform in the 90s, and that involved the closure of Challoner Centre, Basil Stafford Centre, etc., across Queensland. And I embarked on doing a study and in Challoner Centre around, well, you know, what were the processes of people moving out.
And back then you found some resistance.
Even to doing the research. So part of the research involved, I wanted to interview key staff or people in Challoner, and I had, you know, dutifully done my expressions of interest and I had ethical clearance and I put these in the mail room, and only to come back and find they'd all been thrown all over the floor. And so I didn't recruit one person that way, and I had to resort then to, you know, word of mouth. And but again, it was a lot of those stories of people moving out that were just changed people's views. You know, I could tell you a few, but do you want me to tell you one?
Absolutely, yeah.
There was a man who lived in Challoner who never spoke. And because I went there over a, you know, 12, 18-month period periodically just to observe. I'd go down to the canteen and get to chat to some people, and then you'd keep a very detailed journal of this. But there was a man who had never spoken ever. A lot of people in Challoner, you know, they didn't have meals. They had feeding time. And this man eventually moved out, and it would have been in a group. He would have shared with a couple of other people with disabilities. This man was assumed to have, you know, profound intellectual disability. And this was related to me by a staff member. And he had his first meal in the house with a cloth on the table, and the meal was served. And at the end of the meal, this man turned to the staff member and said, "More carrots, please." So all along, this man knew what carrots were, knew to say please. So how does someone who'd lived obviously there for years and years, and I mean, it just strikes you like what have we done to people?
It shows the power of the human spirit, doesn't it, to get through that.
And he spoke from then on.
Certainly with Josie and Kathy, but also in terms of what Kevin spoke about, in terms of he said a very powerful message to me, and that is vulnerability can be strength. So vulnerability is strength. So even when we are in our most vulnerable, we're learning from that. And that speaks to the man you were just talking about, that although he was living in Challoner and obviously very disempowered, when he got to his own place, he felt that he could speak from a position of strength. And ask for something else, ask for something more.
Throughout those stories, there were lots. There were lots of examples of incredible, brutal treatment of those people or their family member. And, yeah, just how vulnerable those people were. But that it comes back to that tough resilience of that they weren't giving up. Josie never gave up. Kevin never gave up. Margaret Ward and Jeremy Ward certainly never gave up. Leanne, you know, they just stuck at it.
And some of the roles that you've been in lobbying as well, Karen, I think of like with the United Nations, how you were a non-government representative to that Australian government delegation, the Australian Human Rights Commission, talking about the elimination of violence against women. Are some of these topics more talked about now than they have been? Is there some progress there?
Absolutely, yeah. So up until recently, I was president of Women with Disabilities Australia, and I've had the absolute honour of travelling overseas and speaking at various international forums. And firstly, that just wouldn't have had a hope of happening without someone opening the door for education. So that's the first thing I wanted to say about that. But, yeah, in terms of rights for women with disabilities in particular, we've been able to have some incredible wins in terms of the human rights instruments and some understandings around particularly forced sterilisation, being in agreed conclusions for women with disabilities and so forth. So I think that's an incredible win for the people that Leslie was just talking about, who are very vulnerable and don't have a voice. And so if we can get some agreed statements across the world about that, that's not okay, I think that's really powerful.
It sounds like we're still needing to raise awareness about the breadth of these issues, that they're not limited to institutions or to particular places, that this is a problem throughout society.
That's right, exactly. We've still got a way to go. And in terms of even governments recognising their obligations under certain UN treaties and instruments, we've still got a way to go. Or even worse, that we'd go back to those institutional models.
If people become placed in such places, they're so forgotten by the wider society. No one knows. I mean, and I'd, you know, done social work and knew stuff about disability, but going into Challoner Centre, even in the 90s, it was such a rude awakening that you think, oh, my God, what are we doing? What are we doing? And so these leaders we've heard from, they all knew that if we don't take this on and push and work on this, that will be the consequence for ourselves or our loved ones or others, you know. And before, I think I used the term slippage, I really worry that it'll become easier to slip back.
What protections do you think need to be put in place to ensure that doesn't happen?
Well, I think certainly we need the legislative and convention and human rights instruments, and all of that has to be, we have to keep coming back to that. But we also have to help and stand by people with disabilities and families, because they know they don't want that for their loved one. So we have to stand by them. And again, it's that share the vision, form the alliances, be strategic and just keep at it. Make sure they're heard.
Make sure their voice is heard.
But there's also points that we can unite on in terms of being a population, like, for example, say around the refugee issue, and, you know, we're closing those people up in institutions, and we're a population of people that have fought against that and have won various struggles to rise out of that system, and we can stand alongside that movement and say, look, we know what this is like. I'm probably going way off topic.
No, but marginalised people unite, really, isn't it?
That's right.
And that overlaps with what we've heard in previous stories too, such as from Kevin, really about that.
Yeah, that's right. And the work he even did to get, like, the convention centre accessible, and that was really amazing sort of work that we all got behind. And, I mean, that's just so important and speaks about the place of people with disability in society. And that's why that a lot of groups still use that venue today, because it's our place. And Kevin made it that way.
He did.
Yeah.
But see, when Kevin then was in another position, a big leadership position as the Anti-Discrimination Commissioner. Mm. And I think, you know, he did all of that work on people from different cultural backgrounds. There's a whole lot of stuff that comes from having alliances with different people who are marginalised. So, and having had that amazing experience of his life and how that informed his understanding of vulnerability, of how people are marginalised and what does it take. So you look at what he's done, and now he's in transport, because he never gave up on that, I don't think. So again, you know, transport, people from different cultural backgrounds, the whole issue of social cohesion was right through that portfolio. But essentially, you know, he comes from that marginalisation of being a person with a disability, but it's so relevant.
And these are they make important links for people and change attitudes more broadly, you think, in the long term.
It's organisations like CRU and some of the advocacy organisations that help shape people's values, isn't it? And that's beyond an academic setting. It's the based on the real world lived experience of people and the everyday struggle that people have faced. And I think, yeah, organisations like CRU and QAI and QDN and even QPPD back in the day.
So a lot of those organisations, they did that, but they also provided lots of training opportunities for parents and people with disabilities, and a lot of that was what gave people the frameworks to understand their experience or what they were observing in the community. So, and I mean, you talked earlier, Karen, about, you know, human rights frameworks. Others have talked about the importance of the whole social role valorisation movement and frameworks around that. And that's the part of giving people the tools to make sense of their experience, because from having those frameworks, that's where you then can think about, well, what are we going to do? How do we move forward? If we have this understanding, what does that mean in terms of what are the alliances? That's the tricky bit.
And bringing the younger people through. Like, that real investment in our young people is just so important, so that wisdom can get carried forward.
This series is brought to you by CRU, the Community Resource Unit. We'd love to hear your feedback on CRU's Facebook page, or send us an email via crew@crew.org.au.
So in terms of overlap, really reflecting, I think it shows how much of this societal change has come from family structures and not formal leadership structures too, doesn't it?
Huge amount.
In those people are these quiet achievers. And see, I'd see Leanne Burke as one of those. She's amazing what impact she has had, but yet she's never out the front. But she's had very clear about the vision, clear about what was important for her sister, but then took to thinking about, well, we won't be able to do it in these big organisations, so how she kind of inserted herself in these small, but this is very quiet leader. She is, I think, one of the real leaders of this field, because she's very on the ground, but she's got the big picture and knows, you know, what is it going to take. And that came from her own experience, but also, you know, her mother did that very early training. A lot of people came out of that very early training in residential care, even that, the name of it, grief. But it was way back when we were moving from a medical model to a more of a community model.
We can't underestimate the power of that.
Absolutely.
I mean, even for myself, I notice with my brother Ashley, just the attitudes in society have changed so much if I go out to have a coffee with him. It's something as simple as that it's not such an enormous big deal. So sometimes you just are thankful that even that little bit has changed, and that hopefully that will lead to something more, I suppose, as people maybe not even think about it, but just take it for granted to see more people with disabilities around and that range of people in society.
And there's an immense responsibility in that, you know, I think. But it's also a very positive and powerful thing to be creating that change and to have people with disabilities and their family members being the creators of change, I think. It's really powerful.
Well, because both of you have been in this field, obviously, for a while, so it's a good thing definitely to reflect on. Karen, when you look back at yourself at school, what would you tell yourself now when you look at where you are now and what you've been able to achieve, do you think?
I guess to set a goal and keep an eye on the prize and to don't stop believing in yourself. And just keep swimming, and you'll get through. But also to find the allies that will help you. That's so important. I wouldn't have got where I am today without some allies. And, you know, they've been people in positions of power, but they've also been peers that are struggling with the same issues, and we've learnt together as well.
And for yourself, Leslie, as well, looking back when you were doing that PhD, do you think, did you expect or foresee that we could be where we are now, or are there things that still need to be changed?
I guess a bit like Karen, I think it's important that people find their tribe in this, that we all need to link with other people to make change happen. So you really need to find who are the like-minded people that you can actually have the coffee with, or you could call on when you're stuck. So I think my advice would be that perseverance is required, but it pays off. But having good people around you will help you to do that. The other thing I think, and this is probably something Michael Kendrick once said, probably he said a lot, but it is when we engage in these efforts, invest where it's needed. Don't try and do everything. I think it's about, you know, like where do we need to have those efforts? And invest in that, put our energies into that, and you might have to let some other stuff go. And the other piece is we've really got to take care of ourselves and look at renewal. Sometimes you have to just step back and let's all take care of each other for a while, because sometimes this costs. It can have personal cost as well, you know. So I'd be looking more at ways in which, you know, you could help people to take care of themselves along the way. Renewal's really crucial. I'd do more of that, I think, if I had my time over, because, you know, when you can get so focused and single-minded that often and you get exhausted by it. So, and then often you're not as effective.
And having that tribe of people to help you along the way, because as you said, many of these, and this is the overlap again with these stories, a lot of these issues and fights took such a long time and continue.
So that's a wrap for our Crucial Conversation series. My name is Nance Haxton, and I've been speaking with two leaders of the disability community, Emeritus Professor and longtime supporter of people with disabilities and their families, Leslie Chenoweth, and QDN Policy Engagement and Capacity Building Officer and longtime disability community advocate and activist, Karen Swift. Thanks so much to both of you for your time, and to our audience out there, thanks so much for listening.